This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Hey, don't be afraid of the...
Welcome to the December 2010 edition of No One Is Illegal Radio. We're part of the CKUT Community News Collective's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal. www.ckut.ca on the web, and we're podcasting to you right now through www.rabble.ca news for the rest of us. We also rebroadcast on Operation Wake Up on CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax. 90.3 FM in Montreal, 88.1 FM in Halifax. You can find No One Is Illegal Radio on the left side of your radio dial. I'm your host, Robin Maynard. My regular co-host, Jaggy Singh, couldn't be here because he's challenging the restrictive and unconstitutional bail conditions surrounding his arrest at the G20 in Toronto this June. Solidarity goes out to all of the G20 arrestees, especially those who are still in jail. On today's show, we're focusing on Canadian mining companies, global land grabs, displacement, and grassroots resistance. On No One Is Illegal Radio, we often focus on the way that border controls are enforced primarily on poor people of color from the global south. Today, we'll be focusing more on the root causes of displacement. We'll be looking at tangible examples of how capitalist globalization forces poor and indigenous people off of their lands, systematically stripping resources from the poor of the global south to the elites of the global north. We're interviewing people from around the world on the effects that Canadian-owned mines have had on people's abilities to govern their lives. And we'll also hear about the power of resistance against these colonial projects. These are the roots of displacement.
~75% of the world's mining and exploration companies are actually headquartered in Canada.
Remember, if hard times ever come, you have a glass of water and a brick of gold. Are you going to drink that gold or are you going to drink that water? Which will sustain your life, the gold or that water?
Thousands of people will be displaced by one mining project. Canadian extractive industries are contributing to global poverty and are contributing to this phenomenon of economic refugees.
Those who are working, those who are not working, those who are just been born, and those who are yet to be born. There is already a death tag on their head. And yet we hear our government always say that mining is actually contributing a lot to the GDP, while Tanzania remains to be one of the poorest countries. Money is preferred than human dignity. Our country has been sold.
The Canadian pension plan is heavily invested in many different mining companies. I can tell you that they have about $500 million invested in Barrick Gold alone.
And those were some sound bites from the interviews that we'll be hearing today. On today's show, we'll hear from Sakura Saunders, editor of the website protestbarrick.net, which is a website that documents human rights abuses committed by Barrick Gold, a Canadian gold company which is one of the biggest mining companies in the world. We'll hear from Evans Rubara, a grassroots organizer in Tanzania on Canadian mining projects in Tanzania. He'll provide an explanation of the role of international mining companies as forces of neocolonialism, resulting in forced displacement and theft of resources. We'll also hear from Carrie Dan, a Western Shoshone grandmother, winner of the Alternative Nobel Peace Prize, the Right Livelihood Award, for her struggle against Barrick Gold's destruction of the Western Shoshone's sacred land in what we call Nevada. Finally, we'll hear from Ulysses Garcia, a Peruvian living in Canada, whose father was assassinated while standing up to the Canadian mining interests in Peru. His community, Tamo Grande, was the first in the world to fight and win against foreign mining interests using a grassroots referendum. His is an inspirational story of the power of direct democracy and resistance to Canadian imperialism. This month's show is produced and hosted by members of No One Is Legal Network in Montreal. No One Is Legal Montreal is part of a worldwide movement of resistance fighting for justice, dignity, and the right to self-determination for migrants, refugees, and Indigenous people. Stay tuned. You're listening to No One Is Illegal Radio. And first up, we're going to hear from Sakura Saunders, author of ProtestBarrick.net. She's going to discuss the world's largest mining company, Barrick Gold, which is based out of Toronto, and its effects on Indigenous people and the rural poor. We'll go to that interview right now. Hi, Sakura. Welcome to No One Is Legal Radio. Could you introduce yourself for our listeners?
Sure. My name is Sakura Saunders, and I'm the editor of ProtestBarrick.net, which is a global network organized against Barrick Gold.
Can you give our listeners a broad overview on the role of Canadian companies mining in the Global South today? Who is profiting and what are the effects of this on communities abroad?
So about 75% of the world's mining and exploration companies are actually headquartered in Canada. And a lot of the money, especially money for exploration activities, is raised on Toronto Stock Exchange. It follows from that people investing in the Toronto Stock Exchange, which is actually international capital, are the ones profiting from this. Another major investor in the Canadian extractive industry is the Canadian government and, by extension, the Canadian public. For example, the Canadian Pension Plan is heavily invested in many different mining companies. I can tell you that they have about $500 million invested in Barrick Gold alone. In terms of the impacts on communities in the Global South, the impacts aren't only on the communities of the Global South, but also largely in Indigenous communities within Canada and the U.S. and Australia, in fact. But the consequences are environmental degradation to environmental devastation, divided communities, militarization, and oftentimes corruption. And you can see how things like this are just the nature of the industry. The nature of the industry is for these large companies to negotiate on many times a national level with these countries, many times third world countries. These nations then sell out the areas inhabited by the rural poor and their Indigenous peoples and sell out the environmental degradation of those areas so that they can generate wealth for themselves and possibly for the national interest.
To get more specific, the website that you organize is specifically focused on Barrick Gold Mines. Can you provide our listeners with some background on Barrick? Who is Barrick Gold? And also, can you give some tangible examples of how Barrick Mines have affected populations and natural environments in recent history?
Sure. Barrick Gold is the world's largest gold mining company. They have about 27 operations around the world. And my campaign focuses largely on communities in Papua New Guinea, Australia, Chile, the United States, Argentina, and Tanzania. In countries like Tanzania and Papua New Guinea, you see how Barrick Gold is heavily linked to militarism. In the case of actually both these countries, many times they'll use the police to carry out their objectives. So one example of this that Amnesty International actually recently did a report on is that Barrick housed police at their Porgera mine in Papua New Guinea. They housed, let these police use their vehicles, and the police presence was there, in fact, based on situation reports presented by Barrick Gold to the Papua New Guinea government. So these police proceeded to burn down an entire hillside of houses where, all the locals will tell you the mine wants to expand into. And, of course, you can just look at pictures of where these house burnings took place, and you can see that it's directly adjacent to the mine. So here's a clear example where Barrick is encouraging and housing the police of a corrupt, least developed nation to burn down the homes of Indigenous people that live adjacent to the mine. And, of course, the fact that Indigenous people are, any people, are living so close to a mine in itself is a horrible human rights issue. In that same country, they dump the mine waste directly into the river system, and the first testing point is 165 kilometers downstream from the mine. So this is in clear contradiction of environmental international norms. In almost every country in the world, riverine tailings disposal, as it is called, is illegal. In countries like Australia, Chile, the United States, you can see how Barrick manipulates things like native title in order to steal indigenous land from the, you know, the people who are entitled to it. So one clear example of this is in Australia, where Barrick negotiated with five unauthorized Wiradjuri people who they got, you know, who registered, were registered native title holders to this area. It's fairly clear that Barrick manipulated that relationship because right after they negotiated with Barrick, they discontinued their native title claim. And the only, you know, they never actually won native title. They just registered a claim so they could negotiate with the company. There's another native title claim holder to that area, and it represents 3,000 to 4,000 Wiradjuri. And that native title claim holder is completely opposed to the mine, which is actually in what is known as the sacred heartland of the Wiradjuri Nation. It's an ephemeral lake called Lake Cowell. In Chile, the Dieguito Huascaltinos indigenous community is currently suing the state of Chile in the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights because they ignored their free, prior, and informed consent and their right to self-determination. And so there's another clear example of Barrick, you know, working with a national government to undermine indigenous rights.
And what is it that is specific about Canadian policies and laws around corporate accountability that are so destructive? And what is the relationship between the Canadian government and these mining corporations?
There absolutely is no laws for corporate accountability. There was a law just shot down by about 6 votes that would have imposed ethical standards on Canadian investment. So this ties into, you know, where is the Canadian government on this? The Canadian government is one of the biggest advocates and investors in the Canadian mining industry abroad. You know, so for example, Canadian diplomats will often be used to promote mining interests within the countries where they work. I, in fact, had a friend, Stephen Schnorr, who made a video about forced evictions in Guatemala, and he actually filmed the actual evictions themselves. The Canadian ambassador actually stuck his neck out and claimed that Stephen Schnorr was using paid actors to pretend that they were being evicted. And Stephen Schnorr recently, you know, sued the government for slander, and he won $5,000, I think, in small claims court. But it's just an example of how Canadian diplomacy is used to leverage the interests of mining interests abroad. And, of course, I already used the example of the Canadian pension plan being heavily invested, you know, billions of dollars in the Canadian mining industry.
This next question is about climate change and the role of continued environmental destruction. Could you talk about how Canada contributes to the destruction of natural resources abroad? You talk a bit about mining, climate change, and what we call environmental racism.
Mining relates to climate change, I believe, because it's a large-scale industrial project. And it takes a lot of fossil fuels. And it also takes a lot of water and produces a lot of environmental degradation, making land less suitable to support life. So, for example, one mine will use more water than the entire bottled water industry. I'm talking, you know, 10 billion liters of water a year one mine will use. And it's a large mine, but even smaller mines use an extreme amount of water. You know, one example that's specific to Barrick is that gold mining costs, you know, $500, $600 an ounce to dig up. The higher the price of gold gets, the larger the ore body that the company will exploit. You know, even if the grade goes down, but the ore body becomes larger. Barrick spends one quarter of their costs on energy. They spend so much on energy that they actually bought an oil company to hedge against the increasing price of oil. To talk about environmental racism, well, I've already touched on that a bit. All these mines are located in areas that are inhabited by the rural poor and They're largely indigenous, in fact. I read a statistic today, in fact, that 37% of Native First Nations communities in Canada live within 50 kilometers of mines. Now, that really isn't true for most Canadians, as mining is something that's very often out of sight to, you know, the Canadian population as a whole. But you see, when you look at just, when you isolate just the Canadian population that's also First Nations, that number increases dramatically. And this is the same is true throughout the world. You know, Indonesia has their indigenous people that, you know, are impacted by these large-scale development projects. And it's not just mining. It's you know, plantations and huge monocultures and things like that as well.
My next question is more of a global question, I guess. It's about how mining is related to migrants' rights. This large-scale environmental and human destruction obviously affects people's ability to live securely in their communities. Jason Kenney, the immigration minister, however, doesn't believe that economic refugees are legitimate refugees. And this was part of his logic for adding the visas onto Mexicans entering Canada. At the same time, however, Canadian mining companies exemplify that displacement is often perpetuated by Canadian companies in the first place. And these so-called bogus refugees are often people who have been pushed off their land, or at least economically squeezed off their land. Do you see a connection between Canada enriching itself off the land, resources, and labor of people in the global south, and the way that it's enacting increasingly strict immigration laws?
Of course. Thousands of people will be displaced by one mining project. You know, there's a Barrick mine in Buzwagi, which displaced 10,000 people. The Bulyanhulu mine in Tanzania, you know, depending on which estimates you believe, the lowest number I've heard is 30,000 were displaced. The highest number I heard was 400,000 people were displaced. And even if those exact people don't end up migrating to Canada or wherever, that sort of displacement leads to rural to urban migration. And that rural to urban migration, you know, turns cities into sweatshops is kind of the phrase I like to use, you know, where, you know, there's overcrowding in cities, all of a sudden labor becomes expendable, all of a sudden employment becomes a major crisis. And, you know, it's very difficult for people to survive. You know, anything that displaces people from the land, they're going to then become dependent on a cash economy and then become dependent on getting jobs and things like that. And therefore, I think it's very real that Canadian extractive industries are contributing to global poverty and are contributing to this phenomenon of economic refugees.
In another way of examining the government's category of supposedly bogus refugees, could you talk about the role of Canadian mines in complacency with human rights abuses in the countries where they are present?
Canadian mining companies often, you know, use the military or the police of their host country to, you know, fulfill their own objectives. Another thing that's been happening a lot recently, especially in Latin America, is targeted assassinations to the benefit of the mining corporation. So in Latin America, especially within the last year and a half, we've seen tons of targeted assassinations of community leaders against mining. And what will often happen is, you know, the mining company will do PowerPoint presentations about and kind of instigate communities against one another, showing pictures, saying these are the reasons you don't have jobs. In other cases, you'll have direct employees for the company ending up getting tried and accused and found guilty of murdering anti-mining activists. In other examples, you'll have the companies working directly with gangs to kill, you know, the mining activists. And this has happened with Canadian mining companies, Blackfire in Chiapas, Mexico, Pacific Rim in El Salvador, Hudson Bay Minerals in Guatemala. And this is all within the last year and a half.
So my last question for you is, what are some ways that you see communities fighting back against the destruction caused by Canadian mining practices?
Communities are mobilizing en masse in Argentina. There's a huge movement to ban cyanide. And if you ban cyanide, that's the main chemical that's used in the process of open pit mining. What they do is they grind up the ore body to a powder fine consistency and then drench it with cyanide solution. And so they're doing these bans on cyanide by municipality in order to keep out open pit mining. Communities are organizing by organizing their own referendums, by organizing, you know, their own defenses. One thing that I would like to add is that many companies out there would like to pretend that these abuses are just a case of a few bad apples. And I think very much the Protest Barrick Project dispels that myth. Because we take one company, and Barrick Gold actually surprisingly has the reputation for being the best gold mining company in terms of their CSR practices, and that's corporate social responsibility practices. And this is largely because they'll sue anyone that tries to say anything bad about them, which you can see in the case of the McGill academics who are now being sued by Barrick for publishing their book, Noir Canada, about Canadian companies in Africa. And so we take a look at Barrick, who's supposed to have this great CSR reputation, and we examine them in about 10 different countries. And you can see the story isn't exactly the same in every country. Some countries will have more militarization. Some countries, you know, will have more, like, corruption. Almost all of them have actually a lot of corruption, and all of them, of course, have a lot of environmental degradation. But you'll see how you can take one company and look at them and profile them in 10 different countries and see at every single site there's problems. And I think that that's just something that people should understand, is that this entire industry is extremely corrupt. It has systemic issues with it, and we need to be tackling these issues. And I think that it is especially a role that Canadians have to engage in, because so many of the mining companies, again, 75% of the world's mining and exploration companies are headquartered here.
All right. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was music from a compilation of rare psychedelic music from Cambodia called Cambodian Rocks. Prior to that was Sakura Saunders of ProtestBarrick.net. You're listening to No One Is Illegal Radio, a show about the frontline struggles for justice, dignity, and self-determination by migrants, refugees, and Indigenous peoples. We're part of Off the Hour at CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Robin Maynard, and I'm part of No One Is Illegal here in Montreal. On today's show, we're focusing on Canadian mining companies, global land grabs, displacement, and grassroots resistance. Next up, we'll hear from Evans Rubara. He's a grassroots organizer in Tanzania, and he'll be speaking on Canadian mines in Tanzania, providing an explanation on the role of international mining companies and neocolonialism, forced displacement, and the theft of resources. We'll go to that interview right now. Hi, Evans. Welcome to the show. Today, we're examining Canadian mining practices abroad and their effects on migration and displacement. So do you want to just introduce yourself for our listeners?
Yes, my name is Evans Rubara. I don't know what to call myself, actually, but all that I know is that I am an activist, and I have been working on natural resource management, looking at the component of the component of corporate social responsibility, and you know, particularly the social, economic, and environmental impact on you know, coming from the extractive industry, and particularly in Tanzania, where I've been working, the issues surrounding human rights, you know, human rights issues, livelihoods, and environmental degradation in the local communities where a gold mine is taking place, diamond and other mining ventures, in Tanzania.
International mining practices are often framed in terms of development, and their human effects are often minimized or whitewashed. Could you tell us about the effects of Barrick-owned mines in Tanzania? What are people facing in terms of the effect that mining is having on people's lives?
There are a number of things really that comes with mining in general. All of us know it's obvious, an obvious knowledge that mining is a finite kind of activity. And what happens with mining is that we always talk about sustainability, you know, sustainable development from mining. And I've always wondered how we can get sustainable development from a finite kind of a sector. But in Tanzania and in a number of countries in Africa where I have worked, one of the most obvious and visible, most visible cases you find in the areas where mining activities are taking place, one is that the local community members are deprived of their own rights. The basic rights are taken away from them. And when we go into specifics, in Tanzania in particular, I would like to register the fact that mining activities started in Tanzania in 1930s. To be more specific, it started in 1931. And the place where Anglo Gold Ashanti from South Africa stands today, that is where the German federal head for the British colony actually was mining gold. And we can't say much of what happened from 1931 when the Germans started mining in Tanzania. But all that I can say is that there was a lot of waste material that was left, and that is still there in a place called Geita, where Anglo Gold Ashanti is still carrying out its mining activities and where actually they have built their base. But when we talk about the multinational mining in Tanzania, we saw this in mid-1990s when the first scenario was that of the exchange between Saturn Resources and Barrick Gold Corporation, which saw, we can call them allegations, but to me they're not allegations because I have met with community members who are victims from the area where Barrick Gold Corporation took from Saturn Resources, which is also another Canadian mining company. In 1996, when they take over, you know, when Barrick Gold Corporation changed hands with a sister company from Canada, Saturn Resources, lives were claimed forcefully. So the first thing which I would like you to know is that where an activity, gold mining, tanzanite mining, diamond mining, coal mining, wherever such activities happen, there are local people. And those lands were not there like idle. Those were ancestral lands which were actually passed over generations upon generations. Now, when Barrick Gold Corporation and multinational mining activities started in Tanzania, and the first thing we had was forced migration of people. What this means is that the government of Tanzania, the government of the day during that time in 1996, struck mineral development agreement with Barrick Gold Corporation, which obviously was struck, the original holder of the license, exploration license and exploration and exploitation license, was given to Saturn Resources. But then came Barrick Gold Corporation, which had an interest, and they bought this and they signed an agreement with the government. And that saw thousands of people who worked as artisanal miners being moved from an activity area where they actually earned a living for so many years. Children went to school. Mothers got what they knew, that this is my money, I can buy something. And families were taken care of, not only families which stayed immediately, you know, those who were staying in the immediate area where mining activities were taking place, but even those who are actually in other villages. Because in Tanzania, even though we move where such activity takes place, it attracts a lot of people who would like to make a living, and so they go to such areas. And therefore, a number of people dependent on that. And statistics show us that
10 years of artisanal mining until 1996. I mean, 5 years of artisanal mining in this area alone, not forgetting that there were a number of areas where artisanal mining was taking place also in Tanzania, there was a lot of revenue collection within the government coffers. And the impact was felt, and the impact was a positive impact. Tanzanians dug their gold. Tanzanians refined their gold in their own traditional way they knew, and Tanzanians sold their gold to the National Bank of Commerce in Tanzania. And that is a story which is well known. So the money circulation was right here in Tanzania. The market was right here in Tanzania. There was no external kind of savings of this kind of monies, and therefore plowing back into communities was so easy. But then come the multinational mining in the name of Barrick Gold Corporation, and other multinational miners like Placidum from Australia. We have Anglo Gold Ashanti from South Africa, a share between South Africa and Britain. We are seeing that there has been a trend where the economic stability, and if we go more in more specifics, you know, the contribution of the mining sector to the gross domestic production is less. And until now, I think we are not even above 4%. And yet we hear our government always says that mining is actually contributing a lot to the GDP, while Tanzania remains to be one of the poorest countries, heavily indebted. Just for your information, every Tanzanian who is born, those who are working and those who are not working, even unborn children in Tanzania, have a debt on their head of something like $250 a year. Those who are working, those who are not working, those who have just been born, and those who are yet to be born, there is already a debt tag on their head. Now, when we go back to what we were talking about, apart from looking at the forced migration of people, people are being forcefully evicted from their areas. There is also the issue of people being turned into IDP, that is the internally displaced persons. When you do not have a land, when your land has been taken away from you forcefully without your own prior informed consent, it means that you automatically turn into a vagabond. You're not just a nomad. You are a vagabond. A vagabond with no hope of home, a vagabond with no hope of a nation, a vagabond with no hope of security from his or her own government. And we have seen a trend in our country that it is not only forced evictions, but Barrick Gold Corporation came with a precedent where life is not valued at all. And even when you bring the issues surrounding the Bulyanhulu killings and burials of people alive in the shaft, mining shafts, you will actually either a plot will be made to kill you, or to make sure that you're completely disabled so that you don't do anything. Money is preferred than human dignity. And we have seen, I have seen for the last 5 years I've worked in this, sector as an activist working on policy issues and mobilizing communities, saying that the trend which has been built and tells us in Tanzania that our country has been sold. Our leaders are not leaders of sovereign countries. Our leaders, those who are elected, given the standing ovation politically by the ballot box and through the ballot box, they are actually federal representatives of Canadian government, or federal representatives of Norwegian government, or federal representatives of other governments where these mining companies are coming from. So decisions made actually in Dar es Salaam are not valid. No matter how much our parliament will try to discuss, The final decision comes from State House, and once State House passes a bill, between State House and the investor coming, that is final. And therefore, maybe there are some changes which are going to come, but the trend we have seen from 1996 until today is that our head of state, particularly even my current president, Jakaya Kikwete, he is being used by the investors, because when you look at even the recently enacted bill, the mining legislation, there are a lot of things which were actually recommended by civil society organizations who have been working on these issues for some time now, and very few of them were actually given out. And one of the fallouts is that people like Barrick Gold Corporation are actually protected, because they have just said that the new mining law is going actually to be effective on the new mineral development agreement, which are going now to be started right now. But those ones which are 10 years or older than 10 years, and that is where Barrick Gold Corporation, Anglo Gold Ashanti, Placid Dome, and all other mining companies in Tanzania, in the mining sector, you know, they fall not under five-year contracts. They fall under 10-year contracts. And if anybody is going to tell us that there is going to be a change, there isn't going to be a change, because those who have stayed in Tanzania for a long time, Barrick Gold Corporation, Anglo Gold Ashanti, Placid Dome, and other companies which are not much known, these companies which are 10 years plus in Tanzania, who, according to the which was passed this year around August, September, they have a provision of immunity, and the same companies have not paid corporation taxes in Tanzania since they started operating here back in 1996, and maybe further than 1996. The trend which we are seeing here is that with this kind of relaxed policies, we see a company like Saturn Resources from Canada. They came to Tanzania. They made their profit. And now our time is maturing for them to start paying the corporation taxes. And that for several years that they are making losses, they changed hands with Barrick Gold Corporation, another yet Canadian company operating in our land. And Barrick Gold Corporation took over in 1996. 2010, we are going into 2011, they have not yet paid the corporation taxes. That is a decade and a half, or past a decade. So I just want to know something. I mean, we are talking about a development from mining sector. Surely, will there be any visible, any substantial contribution from the mining sector into the economic grid of the nation? Or are we still going to have more debts actually given on the heads of even those children who are not yet born? When we look at the trend, again, going back to the trend of these companies, Barrick Gold Corporation, apart from evading the fact that, or refusing the fact that actually they were involved in the killing, forced massacres of over 70 people in the mining, artisanal mining shafts, they have refused to give the country what the country needs to get from them, the corporation taxes.
Speaking of development, you made a really interesting point when you talked about that this is actually a historical problem that's been ongoing since the 1930s. Do you see a connection between the way that international mining companies are acting in Tanzania and colonization?
When you want to look for a connection, you do not have to look anywhere for a connection between a kind of trend and what we are seeing today, because our legislations were actually originally made by our colonizers. The constitution of my country is not purely Tanzanian. It's the Queen. So when you are talking about this trend having a connection with, it is, you know, new wine
in an old wineskin. It is a bittersweet kind of appeal. Inside, 99% is the colonial rule. 1%, and even to give them 1% is to be generous. So I will say that 1% of what we see today is the only new thing. And the new thing in it is that the government will always stand on the platforms and say, we are looking for development. I have never, never had any Western country which says that we are going to create an environment, a friendly environment, for, so that investors. We have the gold. We have the diamond. We have the natural resources which are needed by the West. Should we beg them actually? Should we make an environment to enable them to come? This is a new colonialism. And now it is not that colonialism which we saw. It is not, right now we can say that territorial freedom, independence is there. Okay, Tanzanians can move freely. But it is not also there because you cannot move on your land freely. You don't know the day when the actually coming to knock at your door and to take the piece of land which you have actually you worked on as a subsistence farmer for a long, long time. You don't know when they're coming actually to take it. You know. So basically, I think that we are not free. We are not free, and the worst is to actually see that right now, a lot of Tanzanians live in fear. And just for your information, I mean, they have actually started now looking into mining of uranium. And you know, the saddest, the most, the craziest thing is that Tanzania does not have a policy which talks specifically about radioactive minerals, uranium in particular. But they have the plans are actually very advanced, and people have already started talking about productions by 2012. How do you do that? A government which really has the interest of her people at heart, how can you go ahead and start making such plans when you do not have a policy to regulate and to ensure that your people are safe, your nation is safe, economically you'll be safe? How? How? Well, for me, one thing I would like to say is that, you know, the Canadian government, the Norwegian government, all governments who have a stake, you know, have shares in the companies which have invested in Tanzania, companies which have invested in poor countries in sub-Saharan Africa, which are otherwise rich in mineral resource, to relook into their relationship with us. What we want is that we want what this government would like to see their people receiving from mining companies in their own countries also to be the same practice they should promote in the companies which comes from their countries to these developing countries like Tanzania and Zambia. We should not hear these issues like Tanzania is the most democratic country in East Africa or in Africa. We are not democratic. We are colonized. And our leaders and our decision makers are colonized. They are brainwashed. And I'm not ashamed to say it. They are brainwashed. There is no father in any given context in the family who can actually take poison into their house because someone in the West has promised some money. No. No. It's unacceptable. So your countries, if they want all that, I mean, I'm sorry to say your countries, but if these developed countries, who are investing in our nations, in our countries, want us to want to see more of the Congo, Burundi, and other countries where they have actually fueled conflict, then they will see it in Tanzania, because people are getting tired. Day by day, we are getting tired to be vagabonds in our countries. Day by day, activists who are talking about these issues are actually threatened. Some of us are forced to live in other countries because our governments are not actually ready to take the bitter pill of the truth that actually they have been brainwashed and they're actually used, they're accessories of all the crimes which are happening in the mining sectors in Tanzania and in Zambia and other African countries. We are tired of it. We want peace. We want peace. And that peace will come when the Western greed will decrease. The Western greed is making our lives a living hell.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Evans.
You're most welcome.
That was a post-punk group from Sao Paulo, Brazil, with a song called Policia. Right before that, you heard Evans Rubara, a grassroots organizer based in Tanzania. You're listening to No One Is Illegal Radio, a show about the frontline struggles for justice, dignity, and self-determination by migrants, refugees, and indigenous peoples. We're part of Off the Hour at CKUT 90.3 FM, www.ckut.ca on the web. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. Today's show is focusing on Canadian mining companies, global land grabs, displacements, and grassroots resistance. Up next, we'll hear the voice of Carrie Dan. Carrie Dan is a Western Shoshone grandmother, winner of the Alternative Nobel Peace Prize, which is called the Right Livelihood Award, in 1993, for her struggle against Barrick Gold's destruction of the Western Shoshone's sacred land in what we now call Nevada. We'll go to that interview right now. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
This show focuses on Canadian mining companies abroad and the destruction of Indigenous territories, as well as the displacement of people from their lands. Most of our show so far is focused on how Canadian companies displace people in the Global South, but your example is one that's actually taking place in the United States. I guess before we start, I just want you to introduce yourself for our listeners.
I am Carrie Dan. I live in the Great Basin, also known as State of Nevada. I'm part of the North Central State of Nevada.
And can you tell our listeners who may not be familiar with your story about the struggle that you've been a part of? Your lands are on large deposits of gold. Can you talk about what is the land you've been fighting for?
Well, you know, I've been, you know, involved for many, many years. You know, we have a treaty with the United States of America. It's called the Treaty of Ruby Valley. And I can't understand why people would like to. To us, you know, traditional people, it is like killing the earth. The mines around here, we have a lot of gold mines, and we have one right here at one of our most sacred places. And they're digging underneath that BLM, you know, allow them to do so. You know, so they're supposed to be the caretakers of the land, I guess. And anyway, they're destroying our sacred place. And they're mining there, and I try not to travel through there anymore because it is so destructive. It looks so ugly. It's a total destruction. It's a destruction of our way of life. It's a destruction to our beliefs. It's a destruction to the plant life, anything that's up there. Only thing they want is that gold. Nothing matters. It's a Canadian company. It's called Barrick Gold Strike, I think is the name they go by.
Can you talk about what have been the repercussions on your community and on your ability to sort of live with the self-determination?
Well, you know, it's an area where we gather every year or whenever we're up there in that area. You know, it's a sacred place. You know, it's almost, you know, people refer to as possibly our church. Our church is out in the open, you know. It's not in a building that's built by man. It's among the creation of the Creator. And we believe in spirit life, the spirit life that lives up there. We believe that mountain has a, you know, It houses many things. It houses the spirit life. It houses spirituality. It houses our culture. It's where our people have been for generations upon generations. All life is being destroyed there. It looks so ugly. And I feel that we've been wronged by the United States. You see this happening in other countries, but United States, as far as I'm concerned, is supposed to be a democracy where, you have freedom of this and freedom of that. Well, we don't have no freedom of this and freedom of that. As a matter of fact, we don't have many of the guarantees that's guaranteed by the so-called Constitution of the United States. And believe it or not, the Constitution is a pattern of indigenous laws, the laws of the Six Nation peoples. Very similar to that, if not copied from that. So, we just feel that we have never been treated right. I still think it's a Western Shoshone lands, because when you have a treaty, I feel that you have to sit across the table from each other and make another agreement in order to make changes. I don't think the United States or another country has a right to abrogate the treaties that they have with us.
In 2005, Canada's Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs and International Trade actually condemned what the Canadian mining companies, including Barrick Gold, were doing. And in March 2006, actually, the United States government received a ruling from the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, a treaty body set up by the United Nations and ratified by the U.S. in 1903, that was urging the United States to immediately freeze, desist, and stop any further actions against the Western Shoshone people. Would you say that this has had any effect?
Heavens no. It has no effect at all. The United States has never made an attempt to sit down and talk to us or they just totally ignore it. You know how the United States is anyway. If you don't want to talk about something, it totally ignores it. And that's what they have done with the Western Shoshone case. They're totally ignoring it.
Do you see a connection between Canadian mining companies' practices and colonization?
I don't see no difference. Well, colonization, I guess, to me, that word is a bad word. They treat us as colonies of the United States of America. They're the colonies, they've expanded colonies, as far as I'm concerned, because they are visitors to our country. They always have been and always will be,
As Sakura Saunders pointed out in an interview we did, Canadian gold mining profits are actually part of investment of Canadian pension plans. So that means that average Canadians are actually profiting from the dispossession of Indigenous peoples of their territories and sacred lands in the United States and elsewhere. Do you have a message for the average Canadian who may or may not be aware of where their national wealth comes from in part?
Well, here's what I, say to people. You think you're right, and if you think something is wrong, do something to correct it. Because a wrong can never make a right. And to deny the rights of Indigenous people, I know this happens in Canada as well, to correct these things. We are humans, and we've been to the United Nations. We've been, all over trying to seek if we can find justice somewhere for Indigenous people. And Indigenous people are not only in the United States and Canada. Indigenous people are all over the world. And basically, mining companies treat them just as badly as they treat us. We have our ways, we have our beliefs, we have our spirituality, we have our own culture, which is, totally dying out today. And it's something like, physically, when the United States or, people from Europe first came over, they killed the Indigenous peoples off because, when they're destroying your spirituality, the way you believe, that is a spiritual destruction. It's not a physical destruction. Physical destruction is different from a spiritual destruction. And right now, Barrick Gold out there to our Mount Dinevo, they are spiritually and culturally destroying us.
Finally, could I ask you to just say something about why it's important to resist? You're someone who I think a lot of people look up to because you've been battling these mining companies and the government for so long. So if you just deliver a message of the importance and the power of fighting back.
I mean, we're not asking too much here in Nevada. A lot of these gold mines, what they're doing, including Barrick Gold, is that they pump the water out so they can mine the gold. They pump gallons and gallons of 75,000 gallons per minute in some areas, less than that in other areas. But, you know, that is, water is life. You know, life cannot exist without water. And you see the destruction of that, and you wonder about what's going to happen to the future generations, whether they're indigenous or not, or not indigenous, you know. They got to think about the earth, you know, how important it is. And she must remain that way. We should not be eating, if you get some material, you know. But gold, I see no purpose in gold other than the fact that it's expensive. I just heard over the TV this morning, it's like something like $1,400 an ounce. That's a hell of a lot of money, you know, per ounce of gold. Remember, as hard times ever come, and you have a glass of water and a brick of gold, and that's the only glass of water that's left. Are you going to drink that gold, or are you going to drink that water? Which will sustain your life, the gold or that water? And to me, that's the way I see it. You know, they're grabbing for that brick of gold and destroying that water at the same time. And this is against our beliefs. It's against our ways. It's against the law of the natural world, because all natural world have to have water. And to see the destruction of the water as the way the gold companies are destroying it, it's pathetic, it's shameful, it's wrong.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
That was a track by The X and Tom Cora called State of Shock. The interview before that was with Carrie Dan, Western Shoshone grandmother. You're listening to No One Is Illegal Radio, a show about the frontline struggles for justice, dignity, and self-determination by migrants, refugees, and indigenous peoples. We're part of Off the Hour at CKUT 90.3 FM, www.ckut.ca on the web, grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. I'm your host, Robin Maynard, part of No One Is Illegal Montreal. Today's show is focusing on Canadian mining companies, global land grabs, displacements, and grassroots resistance. For our final interview of the show, we'll hear an interview with Ulysses Garcia, a Peruvian living in Canada whose father was assassinated while standing up to Canadian mining interests in Peru. His community, Tamo Grande, in Peru was the first in the world to fight and win against foreign mining interests using grassroots referendums. His is an inspirational story of the power of direct democracy and resistance to Canadian imperialism. And we'll play that final interview for you right now. Hello, Ulysses. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Today we're focusing on Canadian mining projects abroad and how they affect migration and displacement. Canada is one of the largest global forces behind massive mining projects in the global south. And you have a firsthand relationship to this topic. You've been very involved in grassroots struggle in Peru against mining projects that threatened your town and even your family. So to start off, I want you to introduce yourself for our listeners. Talk about your experience, your community, what happened to your father, and how and why it is that you came to be active against Canadian mining projects.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for that. that's right. My name is Ulysses Garcia. I am from Peru, but I am Canadian too, right? And all my struggling related to mining started in 2000, a Canadian mining company with the Peruvian government support. They want to start a big project in our community in Tambo Grande, Peru. Tambo Grande, Peru is located in the north coast of Peru, almost beside to the border to Ecuador. The main point is my father was an engineer, a former professor who decided to work in his own business in a farming And after 1963, he stopped doing all his investment with all his work and with all the family and all together. And like him, 5,000 other families, they started in Tambo Grande Valley a huge initiative and a huge venture for good farming. Everything was working fine. Everything was working fine. We were producing food, all kind of work for people. People around 25,000 people were working and farming. Everything was fine with all the problems that we have in Peru and Latin America countries, right? But what happened in 2000, the Peruvian government, the same government who sold the property to my dad and 5,000 other families, decided to give a concession under surface to a Canadian mining company. This Canadian mining company, this company was from BC, British Columbia, and decided to start a huge gold mining project. What happened is the gold and all the ore, it was exactly in the undersurface of our properties, where the people live, where people have farming, where people have, when we have the river, mountains, trees. So it was a huge contradiction in the way they, how they can explore this mining when we have in the top of that. So the only way to exploit the mining is you have to relocate people in the surface. But in the surface is a huge valley, 25,000 people working, lot investment, lot effort, and it was for us impossible to accept this idea of to have a coexistence project in between mining and farming. One was in the top and the other was it was below. That's conflict. Like there are all the projects, mining projects in Peru, right? Mining projects in Peru are social conflicts. People start complaining, people start doing everything, people from Tambo Grande, to say the government that it was wrong, that it's impossible to do that project. But in that time, it was a dictatorship. It was Fujimori, who, as a dictator, he didn't ask nobody. And not just that, he was really corrupt. And I don't know how, but they decided to give the concession to the Canadian mining company. In the middle of the situation, my dad, who was the engineer, who was one of the main leaders of the community, he did many opposition to the project. He was the guy or the leader who has the representation to all the farmers. And in all the debates, in all the public debates in the media and in all the public presentation, he put right all the position of the farming, the farmers. And not just that, defending all the rights that we have because we were the people, the Peruvians who took the property before the mining. So, and not just that, we have property titles registered in the public register office in Peru. So it was a huge negative impact, this project, even without exploitation. So even without exploitation, the negative impact, it was like incredible. Anyway, my dad, little by little, was becoming the main obstacle to the project. What happened in 2001, March 2001, one day when we went to the farm with my dad, like 1 mile before we arrived to the farm, one guy with a mask, with a gun in his hand, he killed my dad. Incredible. He like assassinated my dad. He killed him. And anyway, long story short, this is a really sad event for me and for my family, and for the people in Tambo Grande. The conflict in between the mining and the farmers, it become like super conflict, right? I mean, it's very big conflict. So the people who were struggling against the mining, with support with NGOs, Peruvian NGOs and international organizations too, we start thinking about why we don't do something that we can provide, that this project doesn't have the main license, was the social license. The decision and support of the local people if we want or not support this mining project. Mostly because the claiming of the mining company here in Canada and in the Toronto stock market, they were saying that there were just two or three people against the project. And they tried to lie, share people and share holders in the way to get more money, right? Something like it wasn't true. Tambo Grande is a community with 70,000 people. So we decided to organize the first referendum in Peru for decide either people want or no this mining project, because supposedly the government has to do this from the beginning of this. Even before give the license to the mining company, the government has to do a consultation to the local communities, but they don't do that, right? So because they didn't do that, we decided to do ourselves without the support of the government. So what we did was invite Canadian organization mostly, because the mining was Canadian, for to be observers of this referendum or this voting process. So the referendum was running in June 2002, I mean 1 year after my dad was assassinated. The result of the referendum was 98% of the population decide to deny this project. I mean, 98% of the people, that means 27,000 people, say no to the mining project. So even the government didn't support the referendum, and even the mining denied the referendum either, the impact they have in the media in Peru and the impact they have here in the Toronto stock market, it was a devastation for the mining company, because the shares, they fall down from the stock market. And not just that, communities in Peru and communities around the world start doing pressure to Peruvian government in the way that Peru has to decide to support the decision of the people. It has to respect the decision of the people. 2 years later, it was so much the support of the Tamo Grande community from different communities in Peru and different organizations around the world doing pressure to the government that respect this decision, that the government started having a huge hot potato in his hands, in their hands, and in the end they decide don't keep going with the mining project. So that means it was the first case in Peru in all the story after Cristobal Columbus arrived to the American continent, that it was a mining project, it was denied. I mean, Peru, that victory from Tambo Grande was incredible, because in Peru never happened something like that. Peru is a mining country, right? A lot of mining companies do whatever they want, but they never thought the Peruvian government can decide this decision denying the mining project. Anyways, but what happened is, this example of Tambo Grande, it was so huge. The other communities in South America start thinking this, doing the same, right? So in 2003, a community in south of Argentina, struggling with other mining company, they decide to run the second referendum in South America for decide about mining without the support of the government. So the event have the same result as Tamo Grande. They have 85% of the people decide saying no to the mining project. And in 2005 and 2006, I was trying to promote this example of Tambo Grande in Guatemala. And in Guatemala, they start, the people from one community north of Guatemala, almost beside to Mexico, a community named Zipacapa, they decide to run the third main referendum or consultation they call consulta. It was the first Aboriginal or Indigenous consulta for the site about other project with another Canadian mining company. So this event in Guatemala, it was so strong that now, after the referendum or the votation or the consultation in Guatemala in 2006, has been 46 more referendums or consultas in Guatemala for the site about mining, and mostly in Aboriginal and indigenous community. So after the rush of the referendums, more communities in South America or in Latin America, they start thinking about doing referendums. So in 2007 or in 2006, we were working another case in Peru, Rio Blanco case, is in north of Peru too, and we ran a simultaneous referendum in three different communities. So the idea of the referendum, it was try to demonstrate to the government and the mining, they don't have the main license for the project. And the main license for run a project, like a huge mining project, is the social license. It's the license they never they consider to approve. Because they decide this project in tables or in office in the capital of Peru, or the capital of the countries in Latin America, or even in Canada, but they don't ask nothing to people, right? So, and the claiming of the government and the mining is the people is very happy with the project. It's a main source of investment for them. Local community is, it will have work, development, and all kind of propositions or claiming that are not true. Because if people get happy with mining project, why? And the consultation, mostly 90% of the people say no to the project. And people say no mostly because all the claiming of the mining and the governments are not true, right? There is a huge confrontation in this development model with huge mining projects with the development of the people. So it's a kind of huge, peaceful, and democratic revolution that's going on now in South America with the consultas.
From your experience in Peru and in other countries in South America, can you speak a little bit about the effects of mining projects and how it relates to people's movement and their displacement? How does this affect people's ability to live sustainably off their land?
Well, this is a huge negative impact, right? Because people have to be relocated from the livelihood they have, like for like generation after generation. It was mostly happening with Aboriginal or Indigenous communities, right? And in Peru and South America, Aboriginals or Indigenous communities, they have titles, public titles of the property. That's the first impact. It's a legal impact when they want to relocate or they have to relocate a community for new exploitation or mining project, right? So after that, after due the violation of the basic law of properties in our countries, people have to be relocated. And normally it's people who live really peaceful and in harmony, doing a coexistence with the environment, right? Aboriginal and Indigenous communities, the more affected people with these mining projects, normally it's people who is really, really attached to the water, to soil, to air, traditions, culture, all kind of like harmony between all the customs of people and people with the land, right? When they have to be relocated, they relocate to other places, and the people instead to have the development, they said people who are becoming homeless for the poverty, right? And mostly all of them, they in the end they finish in more poverty situation, like increasing the social problems from the cities, right, in our country, because these people who are relocated from the traditional lands, in the end they finish in cities, right? Right? Mining projects don't give profit to the local communities. Right, they build like a small road or maybe they a small hospital or something like that. But the profit, the main profit, is for the mining company for the owners, right? So it's in Peru and in South America, we don't have cases of prosperity for mining. Local communities, we don't have at least one case that we can go and visit a community and say, oh, this community is having development. Look at that, the people are becoming like a. With education, people is really healthy and everything. We don't have that cases. Instead of that, what we have is more poverty, right? We have much pollution. We have a lot of poverty, displacement, and most social problems, right? That's the reason people, I hear many comments here about our countries in South Hemisphere, how corruption works, how people is so poor. It's so poor for this kind of projects in the end. Because these kind of projects are promoting corruption, these kind of projects are promoting more poverty, and these kind of projects, the only way they promote is just inequality for people.
Do you see a connection between these so-called development projects and ongoing imperialism by countries like Canada and the United States?
I mean, like, I hear that comment all the time, right? But in the end, it's like that. It's imperialism, right? It's colonialist. It's a colonialist, but not 500 years ago. It's real. It's now. Because mining companies, in the end, they own the properties, that land, right? Land, this has been part of the community for years and years, hundreds of years. That is the community's fight. That's the reason people give their life for supporting and defending their piece of land, because this is the reason of their life, right?
All right. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you.
That wraps up the December 2010 edition of No One Is Legal Radio podcast on rabble.ca, news for the rest of us. No One Is Illegal Radio is part of the CKUT Community News Collective's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. We also rebroadcast on Operation Wake Up on CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax. Special thanks to Don Paley, Sakura Saunders, Ulysses Garcia, Evans Rubara, Carrie Dan, and Abigail Lund for making this show happen. No One Is Illegal Montreal is part of a worldwide movement of resistance, fighting for justice and dignity and the right to self-determination for migrants, refugees, and Indigenous people. Our campaign is in public confrontation with the Canadian state, denouncing and taking action to combat racial profiling, police brutality, detentions and deportations, as well as opposing the displacement and genocide of Indigenous peoples on Turtle Island.